morning, everyone, and welcome to the Actuaries Institute very first banking seminar, Banking on Change. My name is Estelle Pearson, and I'm the president of the Actuaries Institute. On behalf of the Institute, I'd like to acknowledge and thank our sponsor, SKL, and also thank our supporting partners, the Australian Bankers Association and the Australian Centre for Financial Studies, for their support of this seminar. Now, for those of you who are social media users, you can follow the seminar on Twitter using the @actuariesinst tag and the hashtag bankingonchange. I'm particularly delighted to welcome Wayne Byers, the chairman of APRA, and Guy Debelle, from the assistant governor of the RBA, two of the country's most influential regulators, to our seminar today. Thank you both for taking time out of your very busy days to be with us at our first banking seminar. Now, our CEO, David Bell, will do a more formal introduction of both Wayne and Guy, but I just wanted to personally acknowledge and thank your support of this seminar. Now, as you know, the actuarial profession remains a cornerstone of the insurance and superannuation industries, but is also expanding rapidly into data analytics and banking. So just to sort of put that in perspective, about 25% of our members work in each of life insurance and general insurance, and about 8% work in banking, so about a third of the number who are working in those key insurance areas. And 2 or 3 years ago, we established a banking practice committee to work out how we could support and promote our members working in the banking sphere. And this seminar today is one of the initiatives from that group. So today's program covers a number of topics: capital management, technology, risk management, and product innovation. And I think it gives us two opportunities. Firstly, an opportunity to learn from some of the leading bankers in Australia, and also to demonstrate the range of opportunities that are available to actuaries in the banking sector. So before we kick off, I finally want to congratulate Phil Everett and the Banking Practice Committee for organising today's events. It's always a lot of work to pull a seminar together. I'm sure you'll all enjoy and benefit from today, and I'll now invite David Bell to chair the first session.
I don't need this. Okay. Thank you very much, Estelle, and welcome everyone. David Bell's my name. I'm the CEO of the Actuaries Institute. And given my background in banking regulation, I think it's terrific that we've got this session. The very first time the Actuaries Institute is running a session on banking. And of course, our lead session today is on banking regulation. And the first question that we'll be asking today, and we've got two terrific speakers to answer that, is regulation responding to market change or driving it? So I think that's terrific. And our two speakers today, who I'll introduce just prior to their sessions, are, of course, APRA's Wayne Byers and RBA's Guy Debelle. And if you think your job has some challenges, consider the issues facing these regulators. They have to clean up after the GFC aftermath. They have to establish higher capital buffers. They have to deal with sluggish global growth, ballooning housing prices in some of our markets in Sydney, and rapid advances in technologies and payments. Thankfully, Wayne and Guy are up to the task. Now, in terms of the first session this morning, Wayne will speak first for about 20 minutes, followed by Guy. We'll then have a Q&A session which I'll facilitate, and this particular plenary will conclude at 10:20. So, it's now my pleasure to formally introduce Wayne Byers. Wayne is the chairman of the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority. His early career was with the Reserve Bank of Australia, which he joined in 1984, after more than 13 years with the Reserve Bank, including a secondment to the Bank of England, and he was transferred to APRA on its establishment in 1998. At the end of 2011, Wayne was appointed to the role of Secretary General of the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, a very influential and prestigious role. Wayne is APRA's representative on the Australian Council of Financial Regulators, the Payment Systems Board, Trans-Tasman Council on Banking Supervision, the Basel Committee and its oversight body, the Governors and Heads of Supervision. Please welcome Wayne Byers.
Well, thank you very much for the introduction, David, and thank you, Estelle, for the invitation to be part of this event. Very pleased, on behalf of APRA, we're very pleased to support this event and very pleased to see Actuaries Institute taking a greater interest in banking-related matters. I don't think there's any doubt there's plenty of important issues where the analytical disciplines of the actuarial profession can make a significant contribution to some of the things that we're grappling with at present. So I think it's a very pleasing development. This morning's theme, as David said, is regulation. Are we responding to or driving change? I think that's something, it's kind of a chicken or the egg type question. Because if regulation doesn't have an impact, if it doesn't influence behaviour, if it doesn't drive change, then what's the point to all the effort we put into it? But equally, regulators are not omniscient. They can't foresee with any degree of precision how things will play out. We know financial systems, markets, institutions, products will evolve. So regulation needs to be adjusted and updated periodically in response to market development. So we're both driving and responding to developments that we see. So today I want to talk about some of the changes stemming from the post-crisis regulatory reforms in banking. And they represent both a response to and an attempt to drive some pretty significant changes in banking and financial markets. Now, while these measures have international origins, their rationale is actually very similar to that underlying the recommendations of the recent financial system inquiry, and in particular the FSI's first recommendation that authorised deposit-taking institutions, as we call them in this country, should have capital ratios that are unquestionably strong. Strong and resilient ADIs can be and should be important shock absorbers in difficult times. On the other hand, if the strength of ADIs is called into question, then it's going to tend to exacerbate whatever difficulties or stresses might already be occurring. The FSI established the unquestionably strong concept in terms of capital ratios, but I think it's important to point out that to be truly unquestionably strong, an ADI is going to need to have more than just a strong capital ratio. To be sure, it's next to impossible to be regarded as unquestionably strong if your capital base is weak, so capital's got to remain at the core of the definition. But other measures, such as liquidity and earnings and asset quality, are important too. And even then, an ADI with strong financial metrics but weaknesses in risk management and governance and culture, we'll surely see its financial strength eroded. It's really only a matter of time. So when we look to define an unquestionably strong ADI, these other characteristics also have to be taken into account. So what I want to do in my time this morning is really run the ruler over the Australian banking sector and see how it shapes up against the broad reform agenda and its goal to produce stronger banks. So I'll start at the obvious place with capital. Greater capital strength was the cornerstone of the post-crisis reform agenda, and it's at the heart of Basel III. It's really at the heart of the FSI recommendations as well. Those charts, hopefully you can, they might be a little bit small for those of you who are in the back rows, so I'll give them some context as we talk. In a speech I gave yesterday, I made some observations on how we see the capital strength of the Australian banking sector. In short, we've got a sector that's very soundly capitalised, and the left-hand chart is really showing that risk-based capital ratios are as high as they've ever been. And these ratios have been achieved with tighter definitions of what counts as capital. Compared internationally, Australian common equity tier 1 ratios, core equity ratios, are comfortably in the top half of the spectrum, although they might need to be higher still to retain their relative positioning over time. And international developments might well also necessitate higher capital levels, but given the situation we're in today, this challenge should be quite manageable, provided ADIs do continue to sensibly accumulate capital. But Basel III also noted the importance of looking at leverage as well as capital adequacy, and the right-hand chart is really showing that leverage ratios have not been materially strengthened thus far, and the largest Australian banks compare less well on this measure compared to peers. Certainly, where we sit today, the Australian ADIs have leverage ratios that are well above the 3% minimum currently envisaged by the Basel Committee, and leverage ratios in any event are only intended to be a backstop. But the point is really we shouldn't lose sight of them altogether. When it comes to liquidity, we saw the introduction of global liquidity and funding standards in Basel III. The 30-day liquidity coverage ratio, or LCR, and the longer-term net stable funding ratio, the NSFR. I think these measures potentially have a greater impact on the Australian banking sector, given its excess of loans over deposits and its reliance on foreign funding, than any of the changes to the capital framework. We introduced the LCR in Australia at the beginning of this year for a group of larger banks, and I think we would regard it as having improved bank liquidity in four key ways. So first of all, it shifted the measure of required liquidity from a one-week test to a one-month test, requiring banks to hold more liquidity as a result. Second, it eliminated the past practice of banks holding as liquid assets the debts of each other. So, in other words, the quality of liquid assets is now more independent of the health of the banking system. Third, the Australian version of the LCR provided for banks to be able to meet their requirements for high-quality liquid assets by establishing and paying for a committed liquidity facility with the RBA. And then fourth, liquidity risk management and governance has been materially strengthened along the way. So all of these steps mean that banks are maintaining a stronger liquidity position than was previously the case. And then more broadly, the chart on the right-hand side is really giving a picture that says the funding profile of the Australian banking system has improved in the post-crisis environment. So ADIs have sourced a much greater proportion of their funding from deposits and reduced their reliance on short-term wholesale debt. Now, it's difficult to know how much of this is regulatory-induced change and how much is bank liquidity risk management practices being recalibrated to take into account the experiences of late 2008. But I think these compositional changes should strengthen liquidity and funding profiles overall. Within those broad trends, however, a couple of things that I think bear a little bit more scrutiny. So first of all, while banks have actively pursued deposit growth, not all deposits have similar liquidity characteristics. So in recent years, the chart on the left is essentially saying that deposit growth has primarily come from or in the form of at-call rather than term deposits. So the apparent ceasefire in the war for deposits means liquidity profiles have been strengthened less than that might first appear. And then secondly, on the right-hand side, while the industry has reduced its reliance on short-term funding, it's reduced its reliance on wholesale funding, and it's reduced its reliance on offshore funding, somewhat paradoxically, it hasn't materially reduced its reliance on the form of funding that is most likely enabled to run in a crisis, and that is short-term wholesale funding from offshore. That might, as I said, might seem a bit paradoxical, but as a percentage of total funding, short-term wholesale funding from offshore is virtually unchanged from a decade ago. Now, the net stable funding ratio, which is going to provide a longer-term funding mismatch measure to complement the short-term liquidity coverage ratio, it's not scheduled for introduction until 2018. We're going to consult further on its implementation in Australia in the coming months, and so I'm not going to say too much more about it today. The only observation I want to make is that given their funding structures, the largest Australian banks don't easily meet the new standard, and as things stand today, international comparisons are not particularly favourable to them. So some further lengthening of Australian bank maturity profiles is therefore likely to be needed over time to truly strengthen their funding resilience. And that's an important issue to address, because a key rationale for the FSI's unquestionably strong recommendation was this recognition that this funding issue has been a key vulnerability in the past. A positive story for the Australian banking sector over the past couple of decades has been relatively strong asset quality. A notable increase in non-performing loans in the aftermath of the global financial crisis. But problem loans have since fallen back closer to pre-crisis levels. The only exception, possibly personal lending, but it makes up less than 5% of the total loan portfolio, so it doesn't really have a material impact in aggregate. Now, to give that chart on the left a little more context, aggregate non-performing loans are now less than 1% of gross lending. They peaked close to 2% in 2010. But 2010 was actually a blip when compared to the aftermath of the recession in the early 90s. Then the ratio peaked at almost 8%. So today's levels are low. Whether you examine them historically or internationally, today's levels are quite low. One area, though, that's been of significant regulatory interest, even if it attracts slightly less public attention than capital and liquidity, has been provisioning for problem loans. Now, this is an area where it's probably fair to say prudential regulators like APRA and the accounting standards editors have not always seen eye to eye. For those of you who know anything about accounting standards, the introduction of IAS 39 introduced into the accounting framework the concept of an incurred loss model for provisioning, a concept that obviously insurance actuaries would have some familiarity with. That incurred loss model for provisioning, I think, has always made prudential regulators a little uneasy, and I suspect if you looked at it in the context of insurance provisioning, it might well make actuaries a bit uneasy as well. Incurred loss provisioning has tended to be somewhat lagging. Certainly provisioning has tended to lag adversity, it's tended to be pro-cyclical, and that's something obviously that regulators like APRA tend to try to discourage. Banking regulators around the world therefore welcome the impending move to an expected loss model with a view to encouraging more proactive and forward-looking approach to provisioning. This change is still to be implemented in Australia. But it should, in our view, lead to a strengthening of provisioning levels. So this is one area where of regulatory change where the impact is yet to be felt, but encouraging more prudent and forward-looking provisioning practices over the next few years will help build more resilience and strength in the banking system and in bank balance sheets. The regulatory reforms that have been implemented in the post-crisis period did not of themselves set out to determine the appropriate returns to shareholders from the business of banking. There was, however, an expectation that returns may well decline, and certainly from the high teens and even 20-plus returns on equity that were achieved by many banks before the financial crisis. By making banks more resilient and, in particular, less leveraged, it was envisaged that returns to shareholders, both expected returns and required returns, would fall somewhat. Now, experience thus far has been that the overall industry return on equity in Australia has actually been little changed. hovering around the 15% mark. But that has masked somewhat the divergent returns achieved by the major banks and the other ADIs. The major banks have restored their returns to around pre-crisis levels, much the same way, very similar experience in Canada. While the remainder of the industry is earning a return on equity closer to 10%. Now that's obviously lower relative to the major banks, but that group of ADIs is still earning a return that's commensurate with large US banks and above that of the large UK and European banks. So I think one of the more interesting questions that I think remains very much open to debate is where the right ROE for a more resilient banking system is likely to settle. And we probably won't work that one out for a little while. Up to this point, I've focused on financial strength of the banking sector, but as I said at the start, financial strength will not ensure ongoing resilience if a bank or an ADI is not well governed and managed. Whatever financial strength exists will inevitably be eroded. So we're looking at unquestionably strong in FSI terms, or resilient in Basel Committee terms. We need not just be mindful of their financial strength today, but also the likelihood that they will maintain that strength over time. Our supervisory approach has traditionally placed fairly strong emphasis on the governance and risk management of financial institutions. Since the financial crisis, remuneration arrangements and risk culture have also received more prominence. We see these as areas that provide strong indicators of how confident we should be about an ADI's current financial health being maintained into the future. I think recent papers by the Financial Stability Board and the Basel Committee on topics like governance and risk management and risk culture and remuneration, they've all reinforced the importance of these assessments. So within APRA, we've recently established a small team that's going to act as something of a centre of expertise to help drive our supervisory efforts in relation to governance, culture and remuneration. We think these three issues are highly interrelated. Our assessment today is that, broadly speaking, the governance standards in Australia have probably already addressed most of the issues covered by the new international standards. But then on culture and remuneration, we've got more to do before we can be confident that these are genuinely supportive of long-term financial strength rather than, as we've seen in the past, possible threats to it. And then finally, in the highly leveraged world of banking, financial strength provides comfort and confidence to customers and counterparties that financial promises and commitments will be met. But there can't be any guarantees. So the term living wills has been a new addition to the regulatory lexicon in recent years. The key lesson from the crisis has been the need to prepare for the worst, both in terms of ADIs having credible recovery plans that they can implement to restore their financial well-being after incurring losses, and that the official sector has resolution plans if the recovery plans prove to be insufficient. The ability to handle a period of severe adversity is a key consideration in demonstrating that an ADI is unquestionably strong. If an ADI can't demonstrate that they can successfully navigate difficult environments, then their resilience needs to be bolstered further. They can, of course, be aided in this regard by the official sector, that's us, ensuring its powers and tools for managing crises are in order. And that's also been an important recommendation of the FSI. But the official sector and its actions are intended only to be a last resort. What we're looking for is a higher degree of self-sufficiency. And as I've discussed elsewhere in previous forums, the work we did in our most recent stress test suggests that there's more to do in preparing for those sorts of contingency arrangements. Being conscious of time, let me quickly sum up. Measuring the resilience of the Australian banking sector and judging whether it's regarded as unquestionably strong, it's inevitably a matter of judgment. It certainly requires, as I said in my introductory remarks, more than just a strong capital ratio. Well, it's still a good place to start, but it needs more than that. Having had a quick overview this morning, I think it's reasonable to conclude that the financial health, the resilience of the banking sector has improved overall in recent years. How much of that improvement has been driven by regulation rather than simply more prudent management or market pressure, it's not really possible to disentangle. But regardless, the banking sector has been able to adjust and respond to changes in the regulatory framework and the broader financial environment in a fairly orderly fashion, and that's a good thing. That said, there's still some more challenges and risks to grapple with, a few more regulatory changes coming down the pipeline, and the environment is inevitably going to evolve further. Being able to respond and adapt to those changes and events without too much difficulty will be important for demonstrating that the Australian community, international investors, should continue to have confidence in the strength and the resilience of the Australian banking industry. That ability to successfully deal with changing and at times adverse circumstances is, after all, the very essence of the resilience that we're looking for. So with that, let me stop there. I think I've used my time. And hand to David.
Hand to me, yes.
Thanks very much, Wayne, and thank you for making that slight adjustment with that interruption. At one point, we had the unlikely prospect of a small child in the room. That's what it sounded like anyway. Would anyone from the media like to adjust anything at all before I introduce Guy? I noticed that thing said battery flat. No? You're right? Okay, it's now my pleasure to introduce Guy Debelle. Guy Debelle is the Assistant Governor of Financial Markets at the Reserve Bank of Australia, a position he's held since March 27. He's also the Chair of the Bank for International Settlements and Markets Committee and is the Bank's representative on the BIS Committee on Global Financial Stability. He's also the Chair of the Australian Foreign Exchange Committee. Guy joined the Reserve Bank in 1994. He has worked at the International Monetary Fund, Bank of International Settlements, Australian Treasury, and is a visiting professor in economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He has an honours degree in economics and gained his PhD in economics at MIT, so you can see there's considerable horsepower underneath that bonnet. Please welcome Guy Debelle. Thank you, Guy.
Thanks very much, Dave, and thanks very much, Estelle, for having me here, and thanks very much for John and Linehan for inviting me. So what I'm going to do today is talking about three current issues in financial markets, which hopefully is of interest to you as actuaries, as it is to me as someone who works in the financial industry, namely bond market liquidity, long-term interest rates, and China's exchange rate regime. So all three of those are having an important bearing on financial market pricing around the world, including here in Australia, both now and I think going to do so for quite some time to come. So they may not sound interrelated, but when we get to the end, I'll pull them all together. So let me start with talking a bit about bond market liquidity. So if you read any financial market media over the past year, you would have been hard-pressed to avoid reading an article on bond market liquidity. Indeed, one of the best financial market commentators out there, Matt Levine, devotes a section of his column to people who are worried about bond market liquidity. So this is a daily column. And notwithstanding the fact that it's published daily, he's able to get material every single day to fill that column. So today I'm going to help him out. Unfortunately, yesterday's column actually said that he's about to stop this. So anyway, I'm going to provide him with some more material and throw my hat into the crowded ring. But not for the first time, as about a year ago today, I talked about this very issue. So why revisit the issue again today? So here are a few reasons. First, 1 year on, there have been a few noteworthy liquidity events in the bond market, including the awkwardly named flash rally in US Treasuries, which actually happened the day after I gave my speech last year, so we'll see how we go this year. There's another event happening tomorrow, which might generate something similar, which is the second reason why I want to talk about this. So the much-anticipated first increase in the Fed funds rate, I'm not saying it's happening tomorrow, but something might will happen tomorrow, has been designated, well, nothing will happen tomorrow, but that will also generate something, has been designated as a critical test of the state of liquidity in the bond market. And third, while equity markets experienced a very volatile month in August, bond markets were somewhat surprisingly relatively stable, as for that matter, were major foreign exchange markets. So that serves to highlight the fact that liquidity and volatility are related, but they're not necessarily the same thing. So what exactly do I mean by bond market liquidity? So generally, I would take it to mean the ability to transact in the bond market without having material influence on the price. For example, if I want to sell my holdings of Australian government securities, how much will I be able to sell and over what time period without having a significant impact on market pricing? So this question highlights, or framing it that way at least, highlights two points. There's both a quantity dimension, how much can I sell, and a time dimension to liquidity. If I just try to sell all my securities at once, my impact on the market is likely to be larger than if I break my order up into small pieces and sell it over a period of time. However, if I do the latter and sell it slowly and gradually, there is a risk that the market price moves against me over that period of time because of news or someone else is selling as well, and I don't get as good an overall price. So the quantity and time element of liquidity is often conflated in the discussion of bond market liquidity. Hence, you can hear it said at the moment simultaneously, it's the best of times and the worst of times in terms of bond market liquidity. Bond market liquidity at what's called the top of book, which is literally the top of the order book, is on a number of metrics as good as it's ever been. That is, my ability to sell a small parcel of bonds very close to the current price is very good. I can probably do it as cheap as I've ever been able to do it. But the depth of book, my ability to sell a large parcel of bonds, is nowhere near as good, and worse than it's been for quite some time. So how can it be that we have both of these two developments occurring at the same time? So the outcome reflects the evolution of the market over recent years in response to technological changes, regulatory changes, as well as institutional appetite for this activity. So in terms of technology, there's been a significant increase in the share of electronic trading in bond markets. In the Australian market, we estimate that electronic trading accounts for around 1/3 of trading in the Australian government securities market, though it's considerably less than other domestic bond markets here, which are mostly over-the-counter markets. In the US, the share of electronic trading is much higher, more than half of total turnover. So with the increased electronification of the market has come high-frequency trading firms, or HFTs. So these firms are providing increased liquidity at the top of the book for small order sizes, but are not necessarily contributing to the depth of the book, given their preference to trade in small size, as well as in many cases, they just have a sheer inability to trade in large sizes because of balance sheet constraints. They have contributed to lower transaction costs, or lower bid-ask spreads, for small orders, but there are question marks around their resilience in times of market stress. The key structural change is the shift in the market share from those who provide immediate and continuous liquidity and have the ability to warehouse risk to those who do the same, i.e. provide immediate and continuous liquidity, but don't have the capacity to warehouse risk. So in this regard, the bond market has followed the well-trodden path of the equity market and later the FX market of increased electronic trading and increased participation by high-frequency traders. So not all would regard the equitisation of the bond market, or for the FX market for that matter, as necessarily as a good thing. And Michael Lewis sold a large number of books writing about how bad this was in the equity market last year. The report recently released by the US authorities examining the flash rally in the US bond market almost a year ago today highlights some of the issues. So to tell you roughly what happened on that day, it was 15th of October last year. It was about 9:30 in the morning US time, 9:26 I think to be precise, about an hour after a slightly weaker than expected US retail sales release, like we got last night, except it was stronger last night. 10-year US Treasury bonds fell rapidly by 16 basis points in 6 minutes. Now, yields go down, price goes up, so hence this is why it's called a flash rally. The price actually went up rather than down. So most of the time you hear about flash crashes, this was a flash rally, which is not a particularly good way of describing it anyway. It's what it's called. So 16 basis points down in 6 minutes, and then it just suddenly reversed course and moved up 16 basis points over the next 6 minutes. So 16 basis points, depending on where you come from, might not sound a lot, but if you translate it in terms of price, that's a very large price movement down and up in a very short period of time. If you had taken a well-timed coffee break over that 12 minutes and come back to your desk, you wouldn't have noticed that anything had actually happened over that time. So, as I said, the US authorities released a report about a month ago. They haven't come to any conclusions about what causes this to occur, though investigations are continuing. But it does provide information about the structure of the US Treasury market through that time, including the share of high-frequency trading firms, although in the US they've now decided to call these things proprietary trading firms rather than high-frequency trading firms. So one interesting fact is that one firm had a relatively high share of both sides of the market through that period. That is, it was both buying and selling, and it was the largest participant actually on both sides. And one of the reasons it had such a high share of the trades during that time was actually it was doing a lot of the trades with itself. So it was actually buying and selling to itself through that period of time, and accounted for a very large share of the volume going through the market at that time. So another noteworthy fact about what happened then was that the price adjustment was smooth. So when people talk about flash crashes, normally the price is here 1 minute and it's here the next. This was continuous price movement the whole time. There was no gapping in prices. So this event doesn't fit neatly into the category of liquidity event. There was no prolonged dislocation where the price gapped rapidly and stayed there, which is often what people have in mind when thinking about the consequences of lower liquidity. Nevertheless, the fact that such events can occur in arguably the most deep and liquid market, financial market, in the world does mean that we need to understand what's going on here. So as well as the impact of technology, regulation has also had a significant effect. Regulatory changes have increased the cost to banks of intermediation and hence liquidity provision in many markets and particularly the fixed income market. This has seen a number of participants withdraw completely from the market and others scale back their activities. Bond desks at banks hold less inventory than they have done historically, given the increased cost of doing so. So this contributes to less depth-of-book liquidity, though not necessarily less top-of-book liquidity. So the regulatory changes were intended to have this effect. Liquidity provision was underpriced previously, and it was oversupplied. Regulation has increased the cost of providing liquidity, and hence has decreased the quantity supplied. So the direction of change should not be the issue here. Rather, the extent of change should be the focus of debates about bond market liquidity. That is, it is reasonable to ask the question, has regulation increased the cost of liquidity provision too far, with the result that liquidity in the bond market is now too low? So that is certainly a discussion worth having. But in the meantime, liquidity in the bond market today is what it is. It continues to evolve, but it's not going back to what it was anytime soon. So participants in the bond market need to adjust to the current situation rather than simply complain about it. As I said, it's not going to change anytime soon, so people sort of need to get used to it. If transaction costs are higher, particularly for transacting in large sizes, then asset managers and other bond holders need to take account of that in the way they execute in the market. For example, one solution may be to execute more slowly in smaller parcel sizes. Execution certainly needs to be more nimble and considered than in the past. But perhaps more importantly, the increased transaction costs in terms of liquidity and execution should actually be taken into account in the way an asset manager actually constructs their portfolio. I mean, it is reasonable to ask the question, why am I actually transacting here and do I actually really need to be doing that? So the difference in transaction costs across various asset classes needs to be taken into account. If transaction costs are higher, maybe I should transact less. That's normally what happens when something whose cost increases, I do less of it. Do I really need to be selling? In some cases, I don't have much choice because the need to transact may be driven by the mandate I have been given. And if any of you have had any experience in changing mandates, that takes a hell of a long time. So at least, though, you need to start the conversation with the provider of the mandate, highlighting the higher transaction costs and the implication that has for the portfolio. Or maybe I need to transact because of redemption flows out of my fund. I have people pulling their money out of the fund, I have to sell the asset to provide them with some cash. So in that situation, if transaction costs are higher, I may need to think about holding a higher liquidity buffer than I did in the past. So if the cost of obtaining liquidity in the market for my bond portfolio is higher than it used to be, then I need to think about weighing it up against the cost of holding more liquidity to accommodate those redemption flows. So let me now turn to another concern that often is expressed around bond market liquidity, namely that with the declining intermediation by banks, the likelihood of market dislocation is high. So this is the thing that often comes up in terms of if the Fed raises rates tomorrow, then the bond market is just going to go into meltdown. So the taper tantrum, also called taper tantrum of 2013, is often invoked as an example of this. And if you can remember what happened there a couple of years back, saw a rapid rise in bond yields in a number of emerging markets, not in the US, following indications that the Fed was going to wind down its quantitative easing program. So as I said about a year ago, I think the issue is not so much one of a decline in liquidity as much as a decline in the capacity to warehouse risk in the market. So in the past, when there was a large sell-off in bond markets, liquidity was actually never that great. So back in 94, when the Fed, just after the Fed raised rates, there was a large sell-off in bond markets with a market structure which was somewhat different from what it is today. So a bank, just like any other investor, has no more desire to catch a falling knife. If the price is falling rapidly, they're not going to get in the way of that in a hurry. Bid-ask spreads widen considerably and the depth of the book deteriorates. That's always happened. However, in addition to a decline in liquidity provision, banks now have much less risk warehousing capacity. They are less able to be nimble buyers of assets. So a bank's not getting in the way of a falling price, but when they think it's falling far enough, they're going to step in quickly. And that's generally what happened in the past. Banks are generally amongst the first to step in and buy when they feel that the price is overshot. So this is one important aspect of meaning by warehousing absorbing risk. As a result of regulatory changes as well as their own risk tolerances, banks are much less willing and able to do this today. So many real money investors, and by that I mean asset managers and the like, are not able to move so quickly to take advantages of overshooting prices. The degree of discretion is generally not as large. Mandates often generally don't allow them to do it. They can't stray too far from benchmarks, and it takes a long time, as I said earlier, to change mandates to respond to changing market circumstances, like years, not let alone months. Are there other participants in the market who are able to move so rapidly and agilely to perform that function today? I'm sure they exist, but I'm not so sure there are enough of them, and I suppose we'll find out the answer to that soon, whether there are enough of them. So if there's less capacity to do this, then prices will move by larger amounts and remain away from equilibrium for longer. Volatility will be higher. That's not necessarily a bad thing, it just is what it is. But with higher volatility, the distribution of price movements have fatter tails, overshooting will be more likely, and that can have long-lasting and more deleterious consequences. So given that, some have recommended that central banks step in and play the role of market maker of last resort. So without debating the merits of that proposal today, it is worth pointing out that the term market maker of last resort is misrepresenting what's going on here. A market maker makes two-way prices. I buy something and then I sell it off on the other side, generally fairly quickly. In a dislocated market, most of the trading is one way. The central bank will only be buying, it won't be selling anytime soon. So a more appropriate description is buyer of last resort, with the risk to the central bank's balance sheet that comes from performing that role. Let me talk something which is possibly of a little more direct relevance to actuaries, and switch gears and talk a bit about whether the government bond rate is still the appropriate risk-free yield. Is it lower now than it used to be, and will it stay there? So on the first question, that is it still the appropriate risk-free yield? The answer is still yes, I think. Ultimately, the risk-free yield will be something that approximates the growth rate of the economy, and on that basis, the government bond yield is still doing a pretty good job. So yes, policy actions in some of the major economies might have pushed bond yields globally lower than it might otherwise have been, but these policy actions themselves reflect the growth circumstance in which we find ourselves. In Australia, partly a result of those policy actions elsewhere, we have seen foreign holdings of Australian government securities increase to over 75% a couple of years back. It's a bit lower than that today. Again, I don't see the fact that there's a lot of foreigners holding our bonds these days as distorting the government bond yield, but again, reflects the world that we actually live in. So if government bond yields are around historic lows, should that be reflected in the discount rates used in actuarial calculations? And how long is that period of low rates going to last? I'm not going to answer that question quite directly, but again, it's useful to think of it in terms of economic growth rates. So secular stagnation, most famously put forward by Larry Summers, is often put forward as a reason why growth rates will be lower than they used to be. There are various theories of secular stagnation around, but a number of them boil down to the proposition that the rate of innovation and technological progress will be lower now and in the future than it's been in the past. So personally, I find that very defeatist. This claim has been made any number of times over the past number of hundred years, including by people like Malthus, and generally it's proven to be wrong. Actually, we know it's been proven to be wrong up until now. Now, one day it might actually be right, but it's not entirely clear to me that that day is today. And as I said, ultimately it's a pretty pessimistic view of the future. And I don't particularly see any reason why we should give up today and think that there's not going to be any technological progress from now to eternity. So I don't buy the secular stagnation argument. I think it's not one reason why growth rates are going to be lower permanently. In Australia, one factor that, which does have a significant influence on real growth rates is the rate of population growth. That has slowed in Australia of late, which means there are some grounds to believe that the medium-term growth rate of the economy has slowed. But if that's the case, then discount rates should probably be lower. But the orders of magnitude we are talking about here are really small. You know, the shift in population growth we're talking about is of the order of 0.25%. Now, I know for actuaries, by the time you accumulate that over a long, compound it over a number of years, that can actually end up to be a big number. But our degree of error around our knowledge of the long-term growth rate is probably a lot more than 0.25%. So I still think, as a result of all of that, that the government bond yield is the best measure to use as a risk-free yield. There may be reasons to believe it's structurally lower than it used to be, but I don't think the fact that that there's not going to be any more technological progress in the future is one of those. Let me just finish by saying a few words about China and its exchange rate, which has been a little bit of that written about that of late, and picking up some of the points which were released in the board minutes, RBA board minutes we put out yesterday. So as you might know by reading the paper, if anyone still does read the paper, these Chinese authorities made a notable change to their FX regime on the 11th of August, so about a month ago. So on that day, they moved further down the path of moving towards a more market-determined exchange rate for China, a development which should be welcome. The initial effect was for the Chinese exchange rate to depreciate by around 4.5% over a few days. That's actually not all that big in the general scheme of exchange rate moves, although it generated a disproportionately large amount of coverage and commentary from the rest of the world. The other thing to keep in context about that move down was it came after the Chinese exchange rate moved up by 15% over the previous year, as it moved up in lockstep with the US dollar. But I want to focus on one particular aspect of the change they put through about a month ago. So as part of their efforts to limit the appreciation of the RMB over more than a decade, the Chinese authorities have accumulated $4 trillion in foreign exchange reserves. That's a fairly big number. This occurred in an environment of a sizable current account surplus combined with significant flows of capital into China, so people investing money into China, as well as very stringent restrictions on the ability of Chinese citizens to take money out of China. However, that environment has changed over the last few years. China still runs a current account surplus, though it's a bit smaller than it was a few years back. But most importantly, China is now experiencing sizable capital outflows as they've eased up on the restrictions of the ability of Chinese citizens to take money out of the country. So as a result, over the last year or so, in the face of these capital outflows, the Chinese authorities haven't been intervening to keep the currency down. They've actually been intervening to offset those capital outflows and keep the currency up. So consequently, China's foreign exchange reserves have declined by around $500 billion over the past 9 months or so. We actually don't know what they're selling. So $500 billion is a reasonably large amount of stuff to be selling into the market. We don't know what they're selling because we don't actually know what their composition of their reserves holdings are. It probably involves some US treasuries and other sovereign bonds. But at the same time, so as we don't know what they're selling, we also don't know what the Chinese citizens who are bringing the money out of the country are actually buying, beyond the odd piece of real estate. But I'm guessing they probably haven't bought around $500 billion worth of real estate around the world. So the Chinese authorities are selling $500 billion, Chinese citizens are buying $500 billion. Both those numbers are very large numbers, and they're probably having a first-order influence on financial markets at the moment. And one way to think about it is that the 10 years' worth of reserve accumulation that the Chinese authorities did was basically accumulating foreign assets for China writ large on behalf of the private sector who couldn't invest abroad. Now the private sector can invest, there will be a switch from the public sector to the private sector as the private sector accumulates foreign assets that they've always wanted to hold, while the public sector sells down its holdings. That is, a fair part of what's going on at the moment is a shift in who is holding foreign assets in China, not necessarily a large shift in the total quantity of foreign assets being held by China, or the Chinese people, both on the private and public side. What matters for global financial markets is the difference in the portfolio choice between those two groups. Does the private sector want to hold the same sort of assets that SAFE, the investment arm or the reserve management arm of the Chinese authorities, has been holding over the last decade or so? That's really what matters in terms of what's going on in markets at the moment. So let me finish by just trying to pull those things together. Talk about bond market liquidity, long-term yields and China's exchange rate. They're interrelated at the moment because of what I was just talking about. China's foreign exchange reserves and the selling down of those probably in part is involving sales of US treasuries and other sovereign bonds because of their greater liquidity. The fact that they can sell bonds in one of the most liquid markets in the world to get the money they need to intervene in their exchange market means they're probably selling US treasuries. That's probably having an effect on global long-term yields. We're seeing an unusual environment at the moment where a risk-off environment, so when things go bad, called a risk-off environment, is associated with sales of the risk-free asset, US treasuries, by a large market participant rather than what normally happens, which is purchases. On bond market liquidity, the decline in liquidity is in part the desired outcome of regulation. Whether it's fallen too far can be debated, but the situation isn't going to change anytime soon, and market participants basically need to just get used to it. They have to consider carefully how their execution will function in an environment of lower liquidity, and they may also need to adjust the construction of their portfolios. Wherever the changed market environment we're seeing at the moment is more conducive to temporary flash rallies, or rallies on that matter, or permanent dislocations remains to be seen. We'll find out tomorrow. The latter, i.e. permanent dislocations, are a significantly greater concern than the former, those sort of temporary flash pressures. The simplest way to deal with the flash pressure is actually to take a well-timed coffee break and miss it. All of these three issues are going to be with us for quite a while to come. So in the end, as I said, they are what they are, and basically I think people in financial market participants just need to adjust to the current environment rather than wishing it was something else. So with that pithy piece of advice, let me finish there.
I invite you to go sit there. Okay, it's now the question and answer session. For those of you who had a sleepless night last night thinking about flash rallies, bond market liquidity and capital buffers, now is your opportunity to address that and put those demons to bed. So, in terms of asking questions, I'm mindful that we have representatives from the media here, and I'll attempt to get your questions in as well. I'm also mindful we have some questions from the webinar. When you do ask a question, just the usual protocol, please, your name and your organisation would be terrific. So, who would like to open up the batting? Yes, we have a question here.
Thank you. Hi, Steve Nagel from EY. Question for both of you, maybe directed towards Guy first, around liquidity. You mentioned the liquidity is more expensive than it was before the GFC. And it's around the committed liquidity facility, and I'll probably irritate all the ADIs by saying I thought it was surprisingly generous in price, not expensive, and for several reasons. You can see that in financial markets, other costs of liquidity. No one seemed to complain about the cost, so maybe that was an indication. And also, collectively, the ADIs have asked for more than you're prepared to give them in total. So I was curious as to whether you weren't inclined to price it more expensively.
So as the owner or founder of the Committed Liquidity Facility, I'm going to be very defensive in my answering this, because I actually think, of course, it's been designed perfectly. But, as I would. But so let me explain how we came up with the price. So what we're trying to do is replicate the liquidity premium in high-quality liquid assets. That's how we try to calculate the price. We've got something on our website that goes into some more gory detail as to how we came up with the price. We are not... So all we're trying to do is replicate the liquidity premium in bond markets in roughly normal times. And our best guess, and it's a pretty difficult thing to do, is 15 basis points is pretty close to the mark. I actually think if you look at the behaviour of banks, they're reasonably indifferent between the two. There are higher rates of return on other assets that reside on their balance sheet, but that's because they've got credit risk in them. We are not trying to extract the credit risk premium because they're still wearing that credit risk, against which they have to do a whole bunch of other things that Wayne talked about. So, I mean, I would say that the thing is appropriately priced because we came up with the price. But but the motivation for the price was to replicate the liquidity premium. The other thing I suppose I'd point out is that this liquidity, and Wayne mentioned this during his talk, is that liquidity provision has always been there implicitly. what we're actually doing now is make people actually pay for it. So the price prior to the beginning of this year was actually zero. Now you're making the banks actually pay 15 basis points, which is higher than zero.
A question from the webinar. This is Alex Kaufman of Suncorp. For you, Wayne, APRA recently asked all AIRB banks to apply 25% or thereabouts asset correlation to the mortgages portfolio. Could you comment on this and any future increases APRA may also be considering to other asset classes?
So, yes, we did. We did raise the mortgage, we tweaked the formula that determines the risk weight for residential mortgages for banks that are using internal models to generate their capital requirements. That was actually a recommendation of the FSI. The rationale for what we did and the rationale for the FSI recommendation were slightly different. The FSI had a very much a competition perspective, and it was concerned about the differences in risk weights between banks that were using the internal model approach and others that were using the standardised approach. We took that into account, but we were also thinking more generally about whether the models that were being used were producing the right kind of outcome in the current environment. We're also observing potential changes that were coming from the international standard setters that were likely going to raise risk weights for banks that were using internal models. So it was a combination of those things, and we ended up saying that we would increase the effect of the change would be to increase the risk weight to around 25% or at least 25%. But I think, as the question was alluding to, we also described that as an interim measure because there are a number of things coming out of the Basel Committee and other standard setters which mean a large number of aspects of the risk weighting framework are potentially up for change. I wouldn't want to imply they're all going to be changed, but potentially they're up for change. So settling the final calibration is something that needs to wait a bit longer until we see where the international standards come out on these sorts of things. So, yes, we raised the risk weight to 25%. Yes, it's an interim measure, but at this point I can't really say much more about what might come down the pipeline.
Okay. Thank you. Questions from the floor?
Hi, I'm Sophia Rodriguez from Market News, and this question is for Guy DeBell. You mentioned in your speech about what assets the capital outflow from China, you don't know what they're buying. What are the chances that capital could find its way in Australia, and what impact could it have on the exchange rate?
The answer is the same as for any other financial market. We neither know what the private part of China is buying, nor do we know what the public part of China is selling. And it's the net, as I said, it's the difference between those two portfolios which makes the difference. So I know as little about it here as I do about in any other market. I mean, the opacity around what people have estimates about what the composition of SAFE's assets are, but they're purely pretty much guesses, sometimes slightly more informed guesses. As I said, you know, we've got one of the largest asset managers, well, the largest asset manager pretty much in the world, although the Fed keeps on reminding me that they've got a larger balance sheet than SAFE does. But anyway, they have $3.5 trillion worth of foreign assets. That's a big number. We just don't have a good much visibility as to what exactly they're holding, beyond the fact that if you've got a $3.5 trillion portfolio, you're probably holding something of everything.
Thank you. I do know we've got a question here from Mia, but is there another question from the floor from a member who might wish to ask? Okay. I did have one queued up at the back. I'll go there first.
Mr. Byers, it's Sue Lannan from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. You spoke about the financial vulnerabilities of the banks. All the big banks, we've seen them raising capital recently. Do you think their capital reserves are adequate now? Are they unquestionably strong? And are they in the top quartile of international banks as recommended by the Financial Systems Inquiry?
So I start with a caveat that these international comparisons are actually very difficult, and you need to be very wary of trying to get into very precise analysis. You actually need to be at a speech I gave yesterday. Where you can go to the APRA website and grab it. So the conclusion that we have at present is that we, to start with the fundamentals, we have a soundly capitalised banking system. No question about that. When you look at the risk-based ratios, as I said here, they're as high as they've ever been. And that chart that I put up was to June, and obviously the large banks have all raised additional capital since then. So the capital ratios are only going higher. What I said yesterday was that when we did the put out our last, we put out this international capital comparison study, we said there was something of a gap to the top quartile that the FSI had recommended, but that the recent round of capital raisings has probably actually closed that gap, or substantially closed that gap. So given all the uncertainties around the precision in these comparisons, then I think at least on that core ratio of common equity tier one, which is the fundamental ratio that we look at, it's probably near enough. Now, things are going to evolve though. The rest of the world's banking systems are still recapitalising, so the top quartile is drifting higher. There'll be further changes to the international framework. There's a range of things that mean you can't just sit back and say, job well done. But I think given our assessment of the current position, we have soundly capitalised banks, they've raised capital, but we'll substantially get them pretty close to that ballpark target, then we've got the time just to sit and see what comes down the international pipeline before we decide to do anything else.
Okay, question from Marcel, and I'll go to you, John, after that. Don't let the media dominate things, of course.
This is a question for Wayne. So the action that APRA took on restricting bank lending to investors in residential properties, do you see that as responding to or driving change? How's APRA monitoring the impact that that has had, and what would cause APRA to sort of reverse that action?
I think it is. I would put that in more in the category of responding to events rather than seeking to drive them. But I think the events, I need to be really careful about the event we're responding to, because it's often seen as some response to house prices, and that's we've never said that's what we're trying to target. Indeed, it's impossible for APRA to try and determine or set or opine on even on what the right level of house prices is. The issue we were responding to was a concern that lending standards were being eroded. Competition, very aggressive competition for business, had seen a gradual erosion over time in lending standards. And traditionally, the housing loan portfolios of the Australian banks, which make up something like 40% of the total balance sheet, have been a very safe, stable part of the balance sheet. And it's really important, I think, for the well-being of the system that that portfolio remains that way. So our concern was that over time we were seeing strong, aggressive competition, and that lending standards were gradually being eroded away. So we wrote out to the industry, and we put a letter out in December last year that said, we really want to look hard at what lending standards are in place, and we want to look hard at growth aspirations, because the history of banking is inevitably a case that where people are growing hardest and fastest, that's where the standards get eroded the most. So we've done a lot of work to try and put a floor on the lending standards, improve serviceability assessments, make sure people are prudently estimating borrower income, prudently estimating borrowers' living expenses, not assuming that interest rates will stay as low as they are today forever. So improve the quality of lending. When it came to that 10% benchmark growth rate for investor lending, we were really just trying to say that is a riff. In the context of the broader system, that was where we could see very rapid growth, accelerating growth, and where competition was probably the most fiercest. And really what we were saying to people is 10% growth is still actually a very healthy rate of growth in a credit portfolio. It's still be the fastest growing part of the bank's loan books, still growing at about twice nominal GDP, so it's not a slow rate of growth, but we were just trying to get people just to take their foot off the accelerator a bit, because it's a means of preserving lending standards. What that means for the housing market dynamics and prices, that's not really for us to say. It's all about preserving lending standards.
Thank you.
John Cavanagh from Banking Day. I wanted to ask Wayne Byers, when we look at the foreign financial press, we see weekly and almost daily reporting on banks being accused of mis-selling consumer products, rigging markets, and being involved in money laundering, whether wittingly or unwittingly. And I think that's what we understand by the culture problem. And we don't see a lot of that here. So I'm wondering what you mean when you say you need to do more on culture, and what you're expecting to see that improve.
So I don't think we've had we certainly haven't had the severity of the issues that existed elsewhere. And if you look at some of certainly some of the behaviours that have come to light since the financial crisis, but also some of the behaviours that led to the problems that created the financial crisis, there were clearly issues of what I would call cultural failings in the way institutions were organised, and the way that they ran themselves, the way they incentivised their people. We haven't had those problems to anywhere near the same extent here, and that's a good thing, but it's not as though we haven't had any problems at all. And so one of the things I've said on a number of occasions is, you know, regulators can bolster capital requirements, regulators can bolster liquidity requirements, can try and put up all of this reinforcement around the system, but the biggest protection that we can have from a repeat of the sorts of behaviours that led to the financial crisis is that institutions manage themselves a bit differently. They accept a bit less focus on the short term and a bit more focus on long-term sustainable businesses, behaviours, products, reflecting the interests of the customer as a priority. If we can get the industry itself, in a sense, to manage itself in a much better way, then the need for much more robust or interventionist regulation can be significantly diminished.
Thank you. Guy, I'm going to ask you to chance your arm on US official interest rates. When might they increase?
I don't know.
And supposing they were to increase, what would be the impact, the immediate impact on the Australian economy? You did touch in your speech upon bond markets.
No, I mean, so the market has a 1 in 3 expectation for tomorrow. It's priced by January next year. That's what the market thinks.
Yeah.
My guess is, if there will be, I'd be surprised if there wasn't a bit of volatility when they raise rates. I think there are, as I've said, I think I said this time last year, when also the market had a 1 in 3 expectation of rising interest rates a few months out from there. There is some stuff out there which is predicated on basically zero funding costs. That probably doesn't work when funding costs aren't zero and will probably fall over. What it is, it's not entirely clear. Are we more confident it's not directly on the books of the core banking system? Yes, which is potentially different to previous episodes. Will there be an increase in volatility? It would be surprising if there wasn't, because historically that's always happened. I mean, I suppose the other point to make is that there's a couple of things which I think are interesting to reflect on. One is, it's 9 years since the Fed last raised interest rates. That's a decently large chunk of people in the market have never experienced an environment where rates actually go up. Some of them, most of them have actually never experienced an environment where rates actually change in the US, let alone go up. So that I think will be that would be interesting to see how that goes. To say this, we've had a long time of this sort of environment, and some behaviours have probably evolved which are not going to be sustainable when rates are no longer at zero, and you know, stuff will probably happen as a result. Every time we've had a rise in US interest rates in the past, of you know, been reasonably few and far between, things seem to happen after that. You would have thought, the only thing I would say this time around is that this is the most well-telegraphed rate rise in the history of rate rises. So if you're not ready for it, you sure as hell have been warned, and really you've got no excuse. You know, the exact timing in the end really is neither here nor there. But as I said, you have no excuse this time around for not being prepared.
Okay. Thank you for not dropping too much of their bet on that question. I think we have a question here.
Comes out loud voice. Robert Armstrong, the NAT. I just wondered why, perhaps, Guy, there's a lot of talk about digital disruption and changes to platforms and the way people do business these days. I just wondered how both the global and the local regulators are thinking about the future impact of that on the banking system as it moves forward.
It's a good question I don't necessarily have a good answer for, because there's a lot of thinking going on but not necessarily a lot of answers. But just as no doubt in all the organisations that you work for, there's a lot of thought being given to, well, what does it mean? What does it mean for individual business lines? What does it mean for individual products? I mean, regulators having to think the same thing. What does it mean for our structures, our frameworks, etc.? Because in many cases we have legislative frameworks, regulatory frameworks, supervisory approaches that are all sort of built almost in a sense of the old-fashioned concept of a bank. It's a legal entity with physical assets, and you can go and you can almost touch them. And that's, you know, the world is going completely in the opposite direction, and the boundary of a bank, where does it start and finish, is becoming much more difficult. So we have to think quite hard about it, and there's obviously the dimensions that are positive in the sense of there's opportunities for banks who are nimble and ahead of the game. There's the competitive threat issue that has to be thought through. There's the security issue, the cyber security issues that have to be thought through. So all of these things are certainly on the agenda. There isn't, I think, probably like industry, regulators are still grappling with knowing where are these things, how are these things going to play out, and therefore what's the right response to them. It's hard for regulators to try and maybe even dangerous for regulators to try and think, as I said in my remark, we sort of know how these are going to play out and therefore set up a regime in anticipation of them, because inevitably the world will go a different way to whatever we think.
Yeah, I mean, to pick up on your theme of your session, I mean, that's one where I think it's reaction, not driving. That's been true for the last, you know, few hundred years, really. There's been technological changes which have come along which have changed the way that that financial intermediation has been provided. Not all of those technological innovations have been for the better, and that's probably going to be the case this time around as well. Some of them clearly have been for the better, some of them not necessarily so. But, you know, there's always, in this part of the space, I think, much more of a reactive thing rather than necessarily a proactive, just because of the inherent difficulty in being able to tell what the future's going to bring.
Thank you. Christian over here.
G'day, it's James Ayres from the Fin Review. Just a question for you, Wayne. It's just to come back to the 10% growth limits on investor lending, if I could. And, you know, I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about your thinking on how that might be impacting on competition. You know, by limiting growth to 10%, some of the smaller players, you know, the impact of that would suggest they aren't able to sort of capture up to the market share of the more dominant players. So I just sort of wondered, is that competitive impact just a sort of a byproduct of the policy, and how do you think about that? And also, what do you need to see in the market before the cap gets removed?
So when we When we were thinking about that 10% number, we did think through the issue of competitive impacts, because clearly we were saying that for some who are intending to grow quite rapidly, there was a need to sort of take the foot off the accelerator a little bit. We did think of it, though, in the context of that was broadly, at the time we introduced that, that was broadly the aggregate growth rate of the system. So it shouldn't be the case that there isn't the capacity within the system. It might mean that you know, business is redirected from different ADIs. Some who were growing slightly slower might now grow slightly quicker. But we didn't seek to put a hard cap on it. We didn't seek to stop people competing on all sorts of other grounds. And we certainly, you know, we didn't seek to do anything, for example, on growth in owner-occupier lending. And so what we've seen now is, at least for a number of organisations, they've switched the attention. And in fact, you can probably get a better deal now. One of the unintended consequences of the change is you can probably get an even better deal now for if you're an owner-occupier. Than you could before we changed. So, yes, it has a change to the competitive dynamics, and we shouldn't pretend otherwise, but I don't think they're particularly adverse, and I don't think that, if I interpreted your question correctly, that there's somehow a capacity constraint in the system overall, because when we thought about that 10% number, we were really thinking about what's the capacity of the system. And, yes, there might be some that grow a bit slower and some that grow a bit faster, but there should be that capacity there.
Thank you.
Elaine Grace, the Actuarial Institute. The Bank of England has recently started conducting a study on the economic risk of climate change and stranded assets. I guess I'm just wondering whether the RBA or APRA have taken any similar studies or plans in the future.
We certainly think about that issue. Have we done the sort of detailed study that the Bank of England has done? No, we haven't yet. We're observing what all the banks are doing in thinking about their approach to climate change and how they want to respond to it. We're thinking about how the superannuation sector responds in terms of its investment strategies, etc. But we haven't yet got to a view ourselves about that we feel we need to opine on those sorts of things just at this point.
So I just say two things. One, purely from a markets point of view, I mean, one question to ask is it priced, right? And also, if you think, and over a long horizon, I mean, if you think about it having an impact over a long horizon, it obviously has an impact in terms of superannuation decisions, which are a long horizon decision. But if you look at, say, the composition of the ASX 200 today, it is not going to look like that in 20 years' time for any number of events, one of which will be climate change. And the question is how much of that is actually reflected in current pricing over something which is ultimately a reasonably long-lived thing. The other thing I'd say, though, is that, as you may well know, that this is an item on the FSB's, quite high on the FSB's agenda, partly reflecting the fact that the chair of the FSB is also the governor of the Bank of England. But nevertheless, it's an item high on that agenda at the moment and for the next while. Indeed, I believe there's a conference in London on this topic in the next couple of days, FSB conference. So the focus on that in the global regulatory community, I suppose, is there at the moment.
Thanks. The passing parade of fruit platters and croissants is telling me that morning tea is almost upon us, so three more quick questions. Sorry, I've got them lined up, my apologies. One, then two, then three. Thank you.
So Nina Larkin from PwC. I guess my question is to Wayne. You opened up your talk today by saying you're very pleased to be here amongst actuaries and seeing that actuaries getting involved in the banking sector. I guess my question is around, well, how do you see the role of the actuary evolving and how we play a role in the banking sector going forward?
It's a nice little task, thank you.
Yeah. So my general proposition is there are a whole raft of issues at present in banking where, and banking regulation in particular, where a really strong analytical discipline is needed. And just to bring one really obvious example, the key current debate in the international regulatory community is the role of modelling in the regulatory framework. And you've got people who say, you know, we shouldn't allow banks to do any modelling and throw it all out. You've got others who are very passionate about it and say, no, it's the way of the world and it's critical that we preserve it. The reason we're having that debate is because I think, first of all, the banking industry's modelling pre-crisis didn't prove up to scratch. And when we now look at the use of models within the regulatory framework, we're uncomfortable with the variability that we observe in the outcomes that are being generated. But we haven't yet got to the bottom of how do we sort of balance those things up. We need better modelling. Modelling will necessarily produce, your model will produce a different model, different results to my model, and they could well be legitimate. But at the same time, how do we know they're legitimate as distinct from, you know, you're doing the right thing and I'm just gaming the system. So there's a huge amount of work there that the regulatory community is grappling with about how can we have comfort to use models within a regulatory framework. This is bread and butter sort of stuff for if you come at it from an insurance perspective, because the whole insurance framework is built on the idea that actuaries have come up with really good, robust provisioning numbers, and that's the foundation on which then regulators determine the capital requirements. In banking, we're some way behind that, and we've not yet got ourselves comfortable. So to the extent we can take some of the disciplines, the practice, the experience, and draw from the insurance world and bring that into banking, then I think that would serve us all quite well.
I had sort of a similar question to that, but it's actually to Guy. So the international debate beyond models is kind of also about the place of risk sensitivity in banking and capital. Do you have any comments on your views about what a loss of risk sensitivity would, how that would play out in the broader economy? Risk sensitivity in bank capital.
This is basically the history of the Basel Committee, on which in the sense of this, it reflects the iterations over the Basel Committee's history, on which Wayne is a hell of a lot better comment than I am, given his direct involvement in it. But, I mean, to some extent, the original capital, but Basel I was basically non-risk based capital. And then Basel II was an acknowledgement of that, and then Basel III is probably somewhere in between. But you're much better to describe that than I.
So maybe try and respond to the question: why do we want models in the framework? Because then you can think about what would happen if you took them out. The whole idea of bringing models into the regulatory framework was because there was a recognition that what we were doing was effectively putting a price on risk. You know, when you assign a risk weight to something, it's like the regulator putting a price on risk. And the price the regulator puts on risk is not necessarily what you might observe as the market price of the risk or your assessment of what that right risk is. You know, most institutions have developed some form of economic capital estimate that is used to price and allocate capital and measure returns, etc. And that's your estimate of the economic risk of particular businesses, and you therefore work out the prices and rewards that you expect from those businesses. When regulators come in with something different, particularly if that something different is binding and above your estimate, then it drives not necessarily the most efficient behaviours. And the whole idea of bringing models into the regulatory framework was to try and better align regulatory measures of risk with genuine economic measures of risk or prices of risk. Now, so we think that's better because it's more likely to generate efficient behaviour, drive sensible risk-taking if the regulatory price of risk is consistent with what we perceive to be the real price of risk. If you take the models out or take risk sensitivity away, then you risk driving a bigger wedge between what people think is the right price of risk and what the regulators impose, and therefore you in a sense are creating a distortion, and in a sense people won't necessarily be making efficient decisions in terms of where they allocate their capital. And so that's the question we have. The thing that stops us going right the way down that path is simply how do you get these reliable measures that regulators can trust.
Right. Unfortunately, time has expired. I know there were a few other questions, so my apologies. We're now going to move to morning tea, sponsored by your favourite US bond, Mark Pleasurely. And then, that's going to be funny. You were serious, didn't you? And then we'll recommence at 10:02. Could you please join me in thanking Wayne and Guy for being here.